From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Self-described digital heretic Evgeny Morozov says the beguiling future portrayed by advocates of digital technology is kind of bunk. It's not only that he thinks the promises are wildly oversold, he believes Silicon Valley is trying to fix things that just don't need fixing. Evgeny Morozov is a contributing editor at The New Republic and a columnist for Slate. You may have read him in The New York Times, The Economist, or The Wall Street Journal. The new book is called To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. Your Twitter profile lists home as the Republic of Mischiefology.
Yeah, that's correct.
So you enjoy tweaking the high-tech people who are relentlessly sunny about our high technology future.
Yeah, I think a lot of them just take their own rhetoric way too seriously, and they don't recognize that a lot of the goals that they're striving towards, goals like openness, are actually very ambiguous, and often they get redefined as tech people embrace them. So the openness in the open government movement of today is very different from the openness that we traditionally associate with open government. For example, traditionally, you would think that to make government more open would be tantamount to making government more accountable, to actually having citizens have a say in how politicians spend money or how politicians make decisions. The kind of openness that Silicon Valley is promoting when it comes to open government is an openness of a very different kind. They have redefined it solely based on technological criteria. So now openness is defined based on 8 or 9 highly technical criteria, whether data is released in open formats, whether it's portable, whether other databases can access it freely and accessibly. And of course, once you redefine openness based on these highly technological terms, even the government of North Korea can claim to be a pioneer in government openness simply by releasing propaganda data about its labor camps in formats that are other than PDF.
Fair enough. There's certainly a broader meaning to openness than simply digital openness. But at the same time, isn't it good that you can see who's giving campaign contributions to who? Isn't it good that you might be able to see who signed that petition to revoke a gay rights legislation? Isn't it good that there is more information out there? Isn't that part of what we're looking for we're talking about openness?
What you have to remember is that very often this newly redefined openness allows politicians to claim that they are actually promoting government openness when they're promoting the very opposite.
Give me an example.
So you have
that.
Someone in the, say, the British government, David Cameron, who is a conservative, comes from the Conservative Party, is not very interested in the questions of openness, but at the same time, he has emerged as the pioneer of open government. Why? Because he does push his government to release some trivial data sets that have nothing to do with politics, that have nothing to do with power. He has his government to release them in open formats, while at the same time trying to abolish Freedom of Information Act in Britain and actually start charging people for filing Freedom of Information requests. To me, that sounds like the very opposite of a revolution in openness, while at the same time, openness as redefined by Silicon Valley allows him to pretend to actually be a great pioneer in open government. But to answer your earlier question about campaign contributions, I think definitely we want to know who's funding what. But the problem is that now a lot of this data previously was in, say, libraries. So you had to go and actually invest some effort into figuring out what was connected to what, who was funding whom. Now a lot of that data is accessible freely. It's very liquid. It's very there is no friction almost in accessing it. And, of course, you can easily build websites or apps that will automatically harass people that you disagree with. I mean, now you can build a drone that will probably automatically take data from a database and just go to harass your opponents in their backyard by, like, you know, humming.
But is it harassment? Is it a harassment to let it widely be known that your political opponent is getting funding from some business that might have an interest in decisions that they're making?
Well, the question is how much friction you want to have in that system. I mean, transparency is not absolute. I mean, you want to have a system where data is accessible, but you do not necessarily want to enable quick harassment based on that data. So you might be putting it online, but if you want to build, say, and I'm very serious about the drone example. If you want to build a drone that will take some data from a database and will then just decide where it wants to go, based on that, you want to probably make it impossible for the automated system to do it without some human intervention. So you want someone to go and fill in a code to prove that they are human. So you can have transparency accessible to humans and inaccessible to machines.
Sure.
This is something that you can do, and like we know how it can be done online. But of course, this is not being done because the assumption is that the more transparency, the better. So we want to remove all barriers to, we want to remove all friction, and we want to make everything very liquid.
Good point. But when you're talking about having to go to a government building to look up this information, Washington State is a big state.
Sure.
If you're out in Northeast Washington, you have to travel hours to get to Olympia to go look something up. Isn't there a value in that, in getting the information out further? Is there legitimate?
Yeah, but again, you are trying to paint me as a liar that I'm not. Again, what I said is that what we need to do is to figure out a way how this data can be accessible to humans without necessarily being accessible to machines. Mm-hmm. And what you have to understand is that when someone goes and builds an online map by automatically taking campaign contributions on a cost that they do not like and visualizing them on a map, and visualizing the contact information of people who have contributed to a certain cause that you disagree with, that does facilitate harassment. And that might create chilling effects on people contributing to political causes because they wouldn't want their contributions to be widely seen, available, and become number one search result for their name, right? And this is the environment that we are currently in. And I think that we need to start asking questions how we can make that environment a little bit less susceptible to these easy acts of harassment, which are happening. And, you know, one way to do that is, again, start tinkering with individual technologies without thinking that any act of tinkering will somehow destroy the internet as we know it.
Sure.
And this is the common defense that you hear from internet enthusiasts who will tell you that any manipulation of databases, any manipulation of algorithms, any attempts to examine how Google works can break the internet. That's the common response, that, you know, the internet is so fragile that any tiny act of regulation will just destroy it once and for all, like it was an atomic bomb or something.
You're listening to Evgeny Morozov. His new book is called To Save Everything, Click Here. And he's very critical about the way that Silicon Valley looks at problems and, in fact, maybe creates problems when there are not problems and creates solutions that are insufficient. You write that Silicon Valley wants efficiency, transparency. We talked a little bit about that, and perfection. You argue for the virtues of inefficiency and opacity, ambiguity, and imperfection. Let's break that down a little bit. Could you talk a little bit more about why ambiguity is important and how Silicon Valley works against the importance of ambiguity, the benefits of ambiguity?
Yeah, I mean, so some of that, I think, did come out in our transparency discussion, but some of it also revolves around, say, how we want our politicians to function, right? And how we want our politics to function. There is this assumption that now that we can store everything that a politician has ever said over the course of their career, we can suddenly start detecting inconsistencies in what it is that they're saying. So when they talk to different groups, different constituents, different, you know, when they talk to each other, we can actually spot them being hypocrites. And we can actually say that you guys are engaging in activities that you shouldn't be engaging in as a politician because you are speaking the double speak, or, you know, you are saying things that contradict each other. And I think if you start from any realistic account of politics and you recognize that politics is all about horse trading and bargaining and getting things done by promising different people different outcomes and essentially not delivering on some of them because you cannot be everything to all people, that model of politics doesn't easily lend itself to technological improvements that seek to automate things like, you know, hypocrisy identification or lie identification in political statements.
Well, I think you're right, but isn't understanding the complexities of politics and the trade-offs, could that not also happen if you're able to understand how people address different audiences and yet how they act in the end? I mean, isn't that just understanding the complexity by seeing how they speak to different audiences? Why does that necessarily keep people from doing that?
What I'm saying is that most of the efforts that I characterize as solutionist in the book, and that's the common theme that unites many of my topics, from politics to fighting crime to writing, you know, programs for education, all of them are united by this tendency to produce solutions without any deep inquiry into how the process they're seeking to improve actually works. Mm-hmm. So when someone builds an app that tries to record for posterity every single tweet ever produced by an elected politician, and you know, the next step would be an app that automatically compares whether some of those tweets are inconsistent with each other, mm-hmm. and then you know, maybe visualize them on some graph to show you just how much our politicians are hypocrites or how big liars they are, right? When you start doing that, my fear is that the only reason why we do that is because our technologies allow us to track it, and not because we have spent any time wondering about how much space we want to leave for our politicians to make decisions, right? So this is the key point, that we're trying to solve problems not based on some deep philosophical examination of how politics or education or crime should, or crime fighting should function. We're doing it solely because we have better sensors, we have better ability to store information, we have better algorithms, and we have a lot of technologists working for Silicon Valley who would love to see those technologies everywhere because they are selling them.
Evgeny Morozov, you also talk about some of the stuff that's being produced to use technology in ways that you think are fixing problems that aren't really problems. And Exhibit A is something called the Bin Cam.
Yes.
What is it? What does it do? And why do you hate it so?
Yeah. So part of my argument is that two things have changed technologically in our landscape. One is that sensors have become very cheap, and now you can build sensors into anything, and they can result in new levels of interactivity. Users can be told to behave differently because now everything is smart, right? It understands what you do with an object and can tell you to do something differently. So sensors is one part, and the fact that now everything has some kind of social layer, Silicon Valley would put it, that now virtually every single decision can be made in consultation with your friends because your social networks are always with you in your smartphones or gadgets are connected to the internet, so your friends follow you everywhere and new types of peer pressure become possible. So Bin Cam is an example of a smart trash can which has sensors in it, so it has a smartphone built into its upper lid. So every time you throw something away, Bin Cam takes a picture of what it is you have just thrown away. It then uploads that photo to a site run by Amazon called the Mechanical Turk, where freelancers are paid to do things that computers couldn't do yet.
To look at your trash.
So they look at your trash to analyze whether you have recycled things correctly, and then they assign you points and based on whether you've done things correctly or not. And then the picture along with the points is uploaded to a Facebook profile, and you're competing with other households. So at the end of every week, the household that has done the recycling most correctly wins.
And it's not just you saying it. Bin Cam documents it.
Bin documents it, and Facebook has some kind of an archive of all the trash.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that, you know, it's an effort to get you to do the right thing,
yes,
which is good. But for the wrong reason. I think the reason why we want to have citizens who think about the environment, who think about climate change, who think about recycling, is primarily because they're concerned about those issues, that they actually develop some understanding of how recycling functions. And not just because they want to accumulate points on Facebook, then they can later convert into buying a latte.
But Evgeny, can't they do both? Can't they both be doing it for the planet and also in a friendly competition? Why is it one or the other?
Because my job as an intellectual is to try to understand what is wrong and what is right. And in this case, I think that you need to understand that we need to do the right thing for the right reason. And then based on empirical work and sociology of incentives, we know that replacing non-market incentives like, you know, political ethics and morality with market incentives results in people who actually are no longer interested in doing things that they previously did because they were concerned with the environment or citizenship. So when you go on the street and you see litter lying on the pavement. And previously, in our hugely inefficient world, where there were no ways to compensate you for doing things with virtual currencies, you would pick up that litter because you thought that's what you need to do as a good citizen. What you would do now in this brand new world where you can be compensated for everything is that you are being given an incentive. You're being given a point for picking up that litter. But of course, in a world where there are activities which do not have incentives like this built into them yet,
that, you will not be moved to do anything unless you're being rewarded with points that can then earn you a latte.
Well, you also talk about that when it comes to our personal health. If you just joined us, Evgeny Morozov is with us. His fascinating new book, To Save Everything, Click Here, takes a look at what he calls the folly of technological solutionism, the idea you get from Silicon Valley that all you need is a device and gathering metadata and you can fix anything. That also applies to, I think you call it the data sexual, the relentless monitoring of our bodies that is beginning to take hold now.
Sure.
Things that you can put on your wrist that monitor everything going on within your system. And it sounds as though you say in a way that's also taking us in a wrong direction.
Well, I mean, again, there isn't a way to understand any of this self. It's self-tracking of everything. It's self-tracking
right.
of health.
Yeah.
It's self-tracking of what you eat. It's self-tracking of the information you consume. And I'm not making any broad claims about the role of self-tracking as such. You need to understand it in every single context. So in the context of health, there is no way to understand self-tracking if you do not engage with the changing notions of health and disease in this country over the last, you know, 50 or 60 years. And the reality is that right now we are living in an environment where our understanding of health has changed to a point where if you no longer feel any symptoms, you think that something is wrong with you and need to go and see a doctor, right? Because people want to monitor, and then they monitor themselves more and more. They discover symptoms. They're being given drugs. You know, there is an interesting relationship between pharmaceutical companies and the doctors, and we are basically in an environment where we're discovering more and more symptoms to buy more and more drugs, and, you know, there is this circle that's going on, and now you have this new devices that allows to monitor ourselves in even more ways. So now you can actually track your sleep patterns. You can attach sensors to your forehead when you go to bed. You can wake up and then see whether something is wrong with you to buy a better pillow, even though nothing is bothering you. You don't feel any physical symptoms, but there is something in the data that tells you that you're not feeling well and you need to take preemptive steps. So you go and order even more drugs and you go and order even better pillows and you can go and go and go and tinker with all of that. And I think that it creates some kind of anxiety. But there is also a second layer here, and that's how it affects our problem solving. So when it comes to things like obesity, it's one thing to be told that you need to walk more, right? But it's another thing to actually have access to infrastructure where you can walk, right? And that's part of the government's job, to actually try to solve problems in ways that go just beyond just easy technological solutions.
But
right?
if the technology tells you you need to walk more, might that not make you more politically active to force your political leaders to create more walkable environments?
Well, I mean, like, what country do you live in? Yes, I mean, in an ideal world, that would happen. But the way it was going to work now is that technology companies will step in and will say that, well, we have this wonderful infrastructure for problem solving, so that now we can actually tell, look at Michelle Obama, right? Look at what her campaigns to cure obesity has done and like how they have progressed since 2008. At the beginning, it was all about, let's go and tie the hands of the food industry. Let's go and make sure that they cannot advertise to kids. Look where we ended up 5 years later. Now it's
vegetable
all about
gardens at the White House.
No, now it's even worse. It's like, let's just move more. Yeah, you need to move more. And of course, moving more is great, but you know, there are structural problems that need to be addressed, and to address them, you need to go and pick up fights in Washington. You need to go and take on the food industry. You need to go a lot of very complicated, hard structural reforms that you cannot just do with an app.
Sure. Finally, Evgeny, I can't let you leave without asking you about Google Glass, the device that's not even going to be on sale for a year, but it's given out to some people. There's a bar in Seattle that has already banned Google Glass, even though it doesn't exist yet. What's your take on that and technology solutionism?
Well, I mean, I think it fits very well with my overall message. I mean, it does make certain solutions very tempting. Again, to take on something like obesity, imagine you shop at a restaurant, right, and you order food, and let's say policymakers, they are obsessed with nudging. They want to make you to do things better, and they want you to be concerned about your health. So you order a food portion, and your plate arrives, and it has steak, and it has some fries on it, and a Coke. And Google Glasses, because they are smart, can actually make those portions look much larger than they are in reality, so that psychologically you get the impression that you've actually eaten much more food than you have in reality. In Japan, and researchers have actually done that. They have built such glasses whose aim is, again, to cure obesity. My point here is that Google Glasses make the environment much more tinkerable, much more programmable, so to
say, right? And that opens up this immense temptations for us as problem solvers. And I just need that. I just think that we don't have a philosophy to resist that temptation. Mm-hmm. Technology can do so many things now, and it can solve problems by letting us monitor ourselves or by even blacking out certain things on the menus in the restaurant. All of that becomes possible, but we don't have a good framework, a good philosophical framework, to decide just how to resist some of those easy fixes.
Evgeny Morozov, the book is called To Save Everything, Click Here, a fascinating read, kind of an antidote to some of the relentless sunny positivism we hear from technologists. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Hannah Byrne, Cameron Drews, Andy Hurst, Amber Cortez. Jack Walters is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.